The Tom Woods Show, episode 2001.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Before we jump into today's topic, I want to let you know we had a little bit of a glitch when we released the 2000th episode the other day. We didn't have the videos up in time, but they are up. And of course, if you're on my mailing list, which you should be, which you can do at tomwoods.com, I sent out the links over the weekend to the YouTube version. There are two videos, actually. That's how long it is. Just to make it less clunky, we uploaded it as two videos. But we also have the Odyssey version. So I've been having complaints that because of I have some copyrighted music in it, which I'm not taking out. And that's meaning that people in some countries can't view the 2000th episode. But again, if you were on my mailing list, you saw that I sent the Odyssey links also. So remember, I have an Odyssey channel, which you can access at tomwoods.com/vid, V-I-D, tomwoods.com/vid. And I'm telling you, you're going to want to watch this. It's hilarious, so much fun. To me, my absolute favorite moment of the entire proceeding is seeing Scott Horton get the huge ovation he obviously deserves. To see him walk in to that kind of a response, I hadn't told anybody he was coming. So it just caught everybody by surprise, and everybody was so happy to see him. And it was very, very exciting. So please, please, I'm telling you, make some popcorn, make an evening out of it. You'll just love it. You'll just love it. You'll be re-energized by it. So tomwoods.com/2000 has all the links, has embedded there the YouTube and the Odyssey version. So tomwoods.com/2000. is where to go for that. Now, today we're talking to Clifton Duncan, who is, or has been up till recently, a Broadway actor and has a lot of experience also off-Broadway. And I want to talk to him because I've been following him on Twitter and his commentary is absolutely outstanding. And he's taken a real stand on this vaccine mandate, and it's come at a very, very high cost to him professionally. So I want to talk to him about that and all these other related issues. So Clifton, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Can you start off by telling people, first introduce yourself to the folks, and maybe telling your story of the lockdowns and stuff? Because I think it, you know, we were all affected by it one way or another, but what it did to you, to your life and your aspirations in particular, is especially unforgivable.
Yeah, it's very frustrating, to say the very least. But for those that do not know me, I am a classically trained actor, or at least I was. And I'm one of those people that I suppose I would say generally the right likes to make fun of in terms of having gone into exorbitant debt, student debt, in order to go to a fancy acting conservatory. I went to New York University's graduate acting program where I earned my master's degree. And for those who don't know, it's in the same league. I think it's actually superior to the Yale School of Drama and Juilliard. We have a lot of really prestigious alumni. It's a fantastic program. And so basically my trajectory was just going upward and upward. And anyone who knows me, anyone who knows my work, anyone who wants to Google any of my accolades or reviews can see that, you know, I was pretty much on my way. And so I got out of school in 2009 and I began working at the top theaters across the country. And then finally, I decided to stay put in New York City, where I moved in 2006 under the Bloomberg regime, the better days. I don't know if it will be the good old days, but basically, I made my Broadway debut in 2017 in a play called The Play That Goes Wrong. I had to leave due to injuries, but then my career began to flourish even more.
Hold on, stop for a minute. I saw you in that multiple times, and I wondered what happened to you. I have told my audience over and over and over again until I'm blue in the face they need to see that play. I saw it with the original Mischief Theater cast when it was on Broadway proper. And then I saw it with the cast that followed that, and then the cast that followed that off Broadway. I have followed that play from beginning to end. They had a thing where if you made a donation of X dollars, you could have a backstage tour. Well, they were halfway through that sentence, and I was already throwing my money at them. I actually had no idea that was you, that you were the same person.
Yeah,
I can't believe this is my favorite play of all time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's hilarious, too. And it's one of those shows where, I mean, there were nights where I went to bed in tears because I was so grateful at the opportunity. I mean, it's not one of those things that I saw myself doing, but just in terms of, and you know this, Tom, I mean, I've never been in a theater where you have for two straight hours, people doubling over, coughing, wheezing, crying with laughter.
That is exactly, in fact, I would be embarrassed to tell you how many times, I don't even know at this point how many times I did, because I used to come to New York a lot, maybe every other month. And while I was there, I would always make time to see that play. And for me, half the enjoyment was looking around at all the people seeing it for the first time and all the pleasure it was bringing them. And plus, it's a combination of things. I'm in middle age, so my memory isn't what it was. And I haven't been there in a couple of years. Now, I know the character you played because the original guy who played it was the one with the sort of gravelly voice. So were you the character who you're up on the second level? The second level starts to come down. You get a phone call, and
exactly.
They have to stretch
yes.
it. So that was you.
Yeah. Yes.
What was the name of the character? I mean, I know the it's like an actor. It's like a play within a play.
Yeah. But right.
Within the murder at Haversham Manor, what was your character's name?
So the character's name, yes, sort of hard to say. So how can I explain it?
Were you Robert Grove?
Yes. The actor playing the character of, I believe it's Thomas Collymore is the character's name, but the actor's name is Robert Grove. So that's the character I was playing, and Robert Grove was playing Thomas Collymore
right.
In the play That Goes Wrong. But yeah, I mean, it's just, that show was so scientific in terms of its comedy. I learned so much about comedy, and it was just it was really, really hard on my body. A lot of us were, I think at least half of us ended up in physical therapy just because of I got a herniated disc. I tore some cartilage in one of my
I'm
wrists.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. It's just that you did that all in the service of the audience. And listen, I know I'm hijacking your telling of your story, and I apologize for that.
Well, it feeds into it, because what it touches on is the joy that I was experiencing. I was so grateful. I mean, it was my first, I'm a very strong singer. People were just sort of convinced that I would be carrying Broadway shows one day, and nobody predicted that it would be a British farce that would serve as my debut. But the point is that, one, it is indicative of my versatility. It's indicative of what I was able to bring to the table. It's indicative of how my joy lay just in working and in bringing joy to lots and lots of people. And you know, my career began to take off from there. I don't know if you were aware of or saw a show called Carmen Jones that we did off Broadway at the Classical Theater of New York with Anika Noni Rose, directed it. But, you know, things were just going up and up and up. And then 2020 happened. And the funny thing about it is that, well, it's not really that funny, but by this point, even though the work in the theater had slowed down, I then began to break into television. I guest starred on 3 of the 4 major broadcast networks. You know, I was living off of residuals and the odd concert here and there in New York as I auditioned and was doing workshops and all kinds of things. And then the world shut down. And the thing about it is that now I'm confronted with people who will tell me that, oh, you know, you're a COVID denier. I was actually ahead of the game. I still have nitrile gloves that I purchased back in February of 2020, because I was watching all of these YouTubers who were saying something is happening in China, something is coming over, and we don't know how bad it's going to be, but the reaction to it most certainly will be. And good Lord, how correct they were.
Yeah.
So I was already isolating and distancing in January. I was masking and gloving in public. There was an announcement, I don't know if you saw this as well, but early in March on the playbill.com website, which is a theater trade website, they announced that one of the ushers that was working at a Broadway show had tested positive for COVID. And I was exactly the kind of people you see on Twitter now who are like, you're putting lives at risk. How dare you?
Gosh,
this is the musicians in the pit, you know? So this was back in March. I was totally there. And then over time, you know, just little things here and there. And I'd already been what they called red-pilled some years before this. So I already had a healthy distrust of the press, the media, the establishment, and so on.
Okay.
You know, so
that
I was,
helps.
I was already an outlier in the industry. So
yeah, okay.
I kept my opinions to myself. It's just funny that I became a mediocre Twitter personality, as I jokingly call myself, once I began actually saying what I think.
Yeah.
There came a point, like there was a story, I think in early April, it was reported by the New York Times, where they added 3,700 deaths to the death toll, but they were all presumed COVID. And I'm saying to myself, hold on, at a time where we need as much accurate information as possible in order to ascertain just how deadly this thing is, why are we just guessing? Why are we just guessing these people are dying. And then there were the different reactions to the protest. I mean, literally within the span of a week, it was, if you are out protesting lockdowns, then you are a selfish granny killer who just wants to get a haircut. But if you're protesting for Black Lives Matter, mostly peaceful protests in which 36 people inexplicably died, then you are on the right side of justice. And it's funny because now the people who clap back at me and say, don't, when I say that the vaccine mandates are disproportionately going to affect minorities, they say, well, don't make a public health a race issue. But just a year ago, these are the same people who were saying not only that Black Lives Matter, that equality is matters, but they were saying that racism itself is a public health crisis.
Right.
So they're more than happy to make racism a public health crisis when it suits their ends and it benefits them. But when it comes to policies that perhaps reflect poorly on them, and I know this is not new to you or any of your listeners, the hypocrisy and the contradictions. But once the sort of 2-week period passed after those mass protests and nothing happened, I mean, in and of itself, the condoning of these protests for Black Lives Matter by the medical establishment in and of itself was ridiculous and confusing to me, because I said, okay, hold on. This is a disease, a virus that you have claimed disproportionately impacts communities of color. And yet here you are endorsing mass gatherings of people in these sweaty, I mean, this is, you know, summertime in the heat, and they're sweating through these cloth masks or these surgical masks that are cheap and which even say on the box. And when I purchased my own masks, which are already hiked in price back in February, it says explicitly on the box, they're not meant to stop viruses. They can't really do it. So, you know, when there was no spike in infection, I said, wait a minute. First of all, I highly doubt that there's a bunch of white supremacists out there who are angry that a bunch of Black people are gathering en masse and spreading this disease that is supposedly more harmful to Black people. So why is the medical establishment condoning this? And then, you know, there are a lot of things that just did not make sense. In New York City, where I lived for 15 years until I escaped that place, they closed the gyms for 6 months, but the liquor stores and McDonald's remained open. And one of my big beefs, and this sort of gets back to the centerpiece of the conversation, is the entertainment industry, the theater industry, the way they reacted to the closures really, really disturbed me and bothered me. They were all in, and I understand to a certain extent, if you're doing theater, if you're doing live performance, dance, what have you, you're in very, very tight, close, confined quarters. A lot of these Broadway houses, they're older buildings. They don't have great ventilation. When you're backstage, you know, there's not a lot of elbow room to move around. When you're working, you're making out with strangers. You're doing very intimate sort of scenes, dance numbers. There's a lot of like direct face-to-face contact. And so I can understand why people have a heightened sense of awareness. But I mean, we're getting emails from our union, the Actors Equity Association, both of our unions, by the way, SAG-AFTRA and Actors Equity. You see other unions and other industries are fighting back against these mandates. Our unions are all in on these things. So there's very little wiggle room. But essentially, the entertainment industry, the theater industry in New York, was just content to sit back and just wait for everything. And I'm saying to myself, okay, well, hold on. How is it that in one of the artistic and cultural meccas of the United States, if not the world, you, the Broadway community, the theater community, are allowing yourself to be rendered non-essential by a doofus like Bill de Blasio and a scumbag like Andrew Cuomo? Meanwhile, again, these liquor stores get to stay open. And I felt very strongly that what we were doing was damaging the culture, damaging to the industry. And yet anyone who spoke out about it, there was a Broadway actor named Chad Kimball who did that show Memphis. I don't know if you saw that a few years ago.
I didn't.
He spoke out about essentially about government overreach, and Broadway Twitter, theater Twitter just clapped back. And I stepped in and was like, you know, he has a point. It's tough because there's no real, you can't really rationalize with these people. You know, I try to say, okay, well, maybe in terms they might understand, remember how we voted in Obama because he was supposed to be sort of the anti-Bush and yada, yada, yada. But then he went on and sort of kept some of the powers and expanded on some of the things that we voted against. But the whole point was that, remember how the Republicans handled 9/11 and the war on terror? Let's be careful that the Democrats that are in power right now don't do the same thing and seize these kinds of powers and use it to their advantage to kind of expand their reach, so to speak. But there was just no getting through because people were convinced, and they still are convinced, even almost 2 years into this, that it is the plague. And when it became very obvious that it is not the plague, people kept doubling down. I began to become really, really disenchanted and disheartened because, you know, you'd be doing these play readings or rehearsals over Zoom as if such a thing is possible. We're all pretending that we don't miss being in person and being live. And to hear these actors, you know, well-spoken, pampered, obviously educated, sneering down on restaurant owners, gym owners, small business owners whose lives have been crushed by these lockdowns was just disgusting to me. Meanwhile, we're being barred from work. They're writing articles in the Wall Street Journal about Broadway performers having to lower themselves to take on regular jobs because there's no industry in New York. Meanwhile, you know, I went to Atlanta, I went to Georgia, you know, I got a job. I said, I'll just work down here and, you know, try to figure things out until all this blows over. And unfortunately, it hasn't blown over yet. So what's happened now is that with all the restrictions and the mandates, which again are supported completely by our unions, I can't move as a free person in New York anymore, the place I called home for 15 years. And I can't work in the industry because all these theaters and production companies are mandating this vaccine that I simply don't want and I don't need, especially because, I mean, I'm under 40. I already had the disease back in December. I just don't understand why I should be forced to take this thing. But it's especially insidious because for actors, unemployment tends to be the rule and not the exception. And no matter what level you are in the industry, you're always replaceable. So there's going to be very, very little pushback, and actors have very, very little leverage in order to push back against these things. But how can you push back when, again, the unions are all about this? So essentially, the story is that in an industry which has gone full in on anti-racism, they are now instilling policies that are going to disproportionately impact people like me who have the chops, the skill set, the training, the experience, and who are very much on their way. While at the same time, they're excluding entire swaths of their domestic and foreign tourist audience that would sustain a Broadway show. There's not enough wealthy white theater goers in New York City to sustain all these top-selling shows that were grossing a million plus at the box office before the closures, talking about Hamilton, Book of Mormon, Wicked, The Lion King, these really, really successful shows. And, you know, I just don't know how they can't see how unsustainable it is and how they're ruining lives and careers. So now I'm almost 40 and I'm back to waiting tables for the first time in 15 years. And even now with Biden's mandates, they're encroaching on me trying to start a new life in a way, because now I'm going to have to subject myself to either getting the shot or having some stranger shove a cotton swab up my face on a weekly basis for the indefinite future. So I know I said a lot there, and there's a lot going on. I hope I'm not as jumbled as I feel like I'm being, but
No. I followed that very linearly. Well, I want to comment on something you said toward the beginning about when we were talking about the play that goes wrong, and it's obvious how much we both love it. And you were saying, but that illustrates the joy that we take from theater. But I, on a much, much smaller level, as an audience member, I derive great joy from it. Every time I went to the city, I would always in advance look up what shows were playing when. And I mean, the dark schedule is roughly similar for everybody, but you know, then the Phantom would have the odd Thursday matinee. Like I knew right. All this stuff, and I knew what I would be in town and available to see and what still has tickets. Every single trip was like that. And now I won't even be back in the city again until such time as all this reverses itself. I'm not going to get a vaccine so I can go to a restaurant, for heaven's sake. As you said, I've also already had it. So there's even less reason for me to consider getting the vaccine. I have to say, it's hard to hear your story and not, and my listeners are going to go berserk when I say this, but, and not just wonder, you know, it's, I know we should stand up and resist, but geez, man, you only get one life and this is it. And, you know, maybe this is one thing where you have to just say, all right, look, you win. Have you ever thought about that? You must have.
Well, there have been fleeting moments where I've said, you know, well, maybe I'll get the Johnson & Johnson, you know, it's one and done. But at the same time, part of it is just the principle of the thing, because we have to know that it won't just stop at these particular vaccines. And it's the principle, it's the precedent. And I don't want to be a part of a medical strategy that doesn't appear to be working anyway. I think ethically, it's just not right. And the strange thing about it is that, you know, anyone who speaks out against this, as you know, I mean, we'll be called anti-vaxxers or whatever. The fact of the matter is, if I were to book a movie that required me to travel to a country, let's say that I needed to get, they suggested a yellow fever vaccine, I would get it because I don't want yellow fever. I've already had COVID. And as everyone knows that the vaccines are leaky. They don't stop the spread of transmission, even if they do reduce the chances of having a severe outcome. So, I mean, I've had moments where I've said, well, maybe I can just, I can just do this and get back to where I was. But outside of what I just talked about in terms of just the precedent and the ethics of the thing and just the lack of any medical necessity, I also ask myself, do I even want to share a workspace, a rehearsal studio, the stage, be on set with people who are so willing to throw everything away like that? And one of the things that I love about you, Tom, is that you're one of the few people, I think maybe you and maybe, I think I saw a conservative commentator named Heather McDonald, who was speaking out about the loss of the performing arts and the arts in general and what they do. And right now, my position is that, why is it that the people that do the art themselves haven't been more vociferous in their opposition to these things that have killed their livelihood and disallowed them from working for an entire year with the support of the unions? But on top of that, the idea, now you have to understand, the people in these industries, they see themselves as bucking the status quo, they're artists, they're rebels. And yet as soon as these bureaucrats come along and tell them that they're not essential and that they don't need to work, they fall right in line with that. There is no space in their mind for the importance of preserving the industry. I think maybe in London, Andrew Lloyd Webber was one of the few people who spoke up and said, you know, we have to open, the show must go on. But meanwhile, our own union, the Actors Equity Association, is sending us emails where they're saying phrases like the show must go on are old and unjust. So, I mean, that's a whole other podcast, because right now they're not only going full on into anti-racism, but it's also the COVID mitigations that are just, they're going to do a 1-2 punch and just completely undermine and destroy the industry. But the broader answer to you, or the broader point that I was getting at, is that even if I were to take this injection, which we will charitably call a vaccine, and return, do I even want to work with these people? Because they were so content in just letting it all die. And what's even worse is that there are people that agree with me, but they've gotten the shot because, you know, I have a friend who's going into the Broadway company, the Harry Potter show. I have another one who's, you know, they're continuing to work. It's just, they are not being more vocal about speaking up and saying this is wrong. Because on top of all of that, I mentioned earlier that because of these mandates and all these onerous restrictions, they are banning from attending the theater the very kinds of people that they want to have in the theater. So they'll say like, well, how come we can't fill our audience? Why is our audience not more diverse? Well, now you're banning from attending the sort of diverse audience that you want. And they can't see that. And to me, it's even more egregious because after this past year, almost 2 years now, of people being beaten up, downtrodden, their whole lives have been uprooted and disrupted, their children, their mental health has been suffering, you're going to rob them of the joy of going to see a play like The Play That Goes Wrong, the joy of going to see a Broadway musical, the joy of going to have your spirit nourished by going to see theater and live arts and performance. I mean, the Juilliard School is down here. The Alvin Ailey Company is here. The Metropolitan Opera is here. Ballet is here. Jazz at Lincoln Center. You know, all these great jazz clubs and comedy clubs downtown in the Village. There's all these great cultural food, cultural cuisine to dine on. And yet you're depriving people of that who most need it. It's not you hoity-toity, quote-unquote progressive, entitled, pampered people who need this. It's the kind of people that you've been sneering at the entire time for the crime of wanting to work. And so with me, I feel like I've seen an entirely ugly side of the industry and many of the people in it that I just, it's going to be hard to forget. And when I see other actors saying, I don't even want to perform for an unvaccinated audience member, because, I mean, on one level, you see that for many of these people, the term anti-vaxxer really has become a proxy for Trump supporter. Yeah. And there is no room in their mind to consider that, well, Black Americans vote over 90% Democrat, and yet they are the least vaccinated demographic. So you might want to reconsider your position on that. But even if I were to come back, I mean, I just don't know how I could sit in a room with these people, just remembering all the things that they've said and done over the past 20 months.
Yeah, I absolutely hear that. And I've thought about, you know, what if it became even more difficult to travel internationally, which is something I enjoy doing. And so if, let's say, I got the vaccine so that I could, you know, fly to such and such country, which I don't think I could see myself doing, but I would be looking around at all the people on the plane, and I would just wonder, well, how many of you people are creeps who wanted to ruin my life? You know, like, whereas I don't have to wonder that quite as much right now. But if it were exclusively these sorts of people, and by the way, there are some people who've had the vaccine who are perfectly normal, well-adjusted people, but and there are also plenty of vaccinated people who don't believe in mandates. I get that. But I myself wondered, well, gee, I don't know. Do I want to necessarily be in a restaurant where it's all just Fauci people? Which is, again, I know that's an unfair proxy because that's not entirely correct, but there's a little something to it. I wonder, also another thing you said about you can't sustain, especially given the expense involved, you can't sustain these major shows just on the domestic population of New York or even really the vaccinated U.S.
No.
For one thing, there's a sliver of the vaccinated population that's even more frightened than all the unvaccinated. And so they're not going to a play no matter what you do. So good luck catering to those people. And then there are other people who just won't come to New York. From the U.S., they won't come to New York. And then there are internationally, well, forget it. I mean, they've closed off international travel unless you have the vaccine. So there's no way this can have a long-term future. Especially a show like, let's say, Phantom of the Opera. It's been around 30-plus years. They're not getting all those people from, you know, people living on 59th and 7th, you know? Like, I mean, those are people, you know, who came from long distances. How are they going to, I mean, in the short run, yes, they get their enjoyment of lording it over people they perceive as Trump supporters. But I don't think that's going to be worth it in the long run.
Well, and here, I mean, here's how foolish these people are. Because this was a few months ago, where I received an email from an equity member. I think it's someone who was going to be in that, what's her name? The Alanis Morissette show, Jagged Little Pill. And they were like, you know, send this far and wide, yada, yada, yada. So there was some angry actor who was talking about how Broadway producers are considering reducing the number of shows from 8 shows a week to as low as 6. And how this is a horrible thing because this is not what's part of our equity contracts. It's not what we negotiated originally, and it's going to reduce our pay. And I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe these producers are slightly better economists than these stupid actors, and they can read the tea leaves and say, hold on, we have all these shows that, as you said, I mean, Broadway musicals, they are so, so ridiculously expensive to mount. They cost a lot of money to keep running week after week. They have to make what's called, you know, their weekly nut. And perhaps the producers are saying, wait a minute, we are imposing these onerous restrictions on audience members. So that's going to keep people away. We're going to have a reduced workforce because we're demanding that everyone on stage and backstage be vaccinated. But at the same time, we're excluding, like you said, lots of our, you know, city dwellers. We're excluding people in the United States, and we're excluding these that are international tourists. You know, Broadway thrives on tourist dollars. And it seems like there are some producers who are seeing this and taking action. But, you know, the actors are so, I mean, I'm so, I hate to say it, I have to be just so negative, but they're so stupid and they can't see it. And it's not like I'm a genius. You know, I'm still early on into my discovery and understanding of economics. I'm like 6 chapters into Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics. I got the first chapter of Henry Hazlitt's book under my belt. But this is not hard stuff. And the fact that they can't see it is just, it's unbelievable to me. But I just don't see how it's sustainable. So all I say now is that this is what they wanted. Let them have what they want. My schadenfreude is on full tilt right now. And, you know, I don't know how they come back from this or how they sustain this. I just don't see it. It's just not feasible. But, oh yeah, this is another thing I wanted to say too, because I think going back to the point that you made, if you're not in New York or you haven't been in New York City proper, or as I call it, the city formerly known as New York.
Yes, right.
You don't know how much these people, these poor people, have been propagandized. As soon as you step out on the sidewalk in Manhattan, you are treated to arrows on the ground telling you where to walk. circles on the ground in front of various doors telling you where to stand. There are placards, banners, ads everywhere telling you to mask up, get vaccinated. You go on the subway, the train announcements put forth the same announcements. You know, you have your governor and your mayor reminding you. So people on the ground in New York City have been inundated for the past, 2 years with this idea that there's something scary going on. And if you step outside and inhale, you have a 50% chance of dying, basically. So going back to your point, there are so many people now that they've terrified of going to the theater. And if you go to like popular message boards, Broadway message boards, you'll see the people posting in there saying that this is what they want. They want more restrictions. They want mandates. They want masking forever. And, you know, I'm like, this is just not how on earth it diminishes the enjoyment for both performers and the audience. And you could only be convinced that this is the right way to go if you're also convinced that we're going through a new Black Death right now. And my approach to this, people call me anti-vax or whatever. I definitely have questions about these vaccines, but my position is, you know, they're only one element of a multi-pronged attack. If you're somebody who is in a vulnerable group and you feel that they would be the best thing for you, then by all means, go out and get the shot. But that doesn't preclude, and this is another strange thing about the entertainment industry, especially actors and performers. We are more health conscious than the general population. It's a part of our job to be in shape. Whether you're doing Hamlet or Hamilton, you need to have a certain amount of conditioning to be able to sustain an 8-show-per-week schedule where you're giving your all, you're filling up a house. I mean, you've seen the play that goes wrong. You can't do that show if you're not healthy. So you're already dealing with a demographic that is healthier than the average citizen, but you're still mandating these shots for it. It just, there's so much about it that does not make sense. And I struggle to see how, unless there's a radical reversal of the group orthodoxy, so to speak, how these things right themselves. But even then, if it did correct itself, will the stain of the way that these people behaved towards people like me, will that be erased? I'm not sure that it will be.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. A lot of people have been putting crypto into their IRAs. And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, adding Bitcoin to your retirement account, the best way is through BitTrust IRA. The crypto world can be confusing. It's hard to know where to get started. These guys will help you. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And by the way, when they say nuclear bunkers, that isn't just hyperbole where they're saying it's really, really secure. We're actually talking about decommissioned nuclear bunkers. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So how do you get started? Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. I want to ask you, even though we've gone over the time I sort of promised, I still have a couple more things I want to ask. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. First one is, you said that you'd been red-pilled some time ago, but there's nothing quite like 2020. I mean, this thing can radically change people's minds. How do you feel you personally? I know you're looking around, you feel like society has changed radically. How has it changed you personally? Is it just, did it confirm the views you had, or has it made you go down more rabbit holes, or what?
I would say more the latter. It's made me go down more rabbit holes. Some good, maybe some not as good. The one good rabbit hole is that, I mean, you have to understand, I didn't even know that there was another way to think, another way to see the world. And part of the cornerstone of my acting training is that curiosity and empathy are two of the cornerstones of the craft of acting. And what I began to notice, especially during the Trump years, which just completely broke people's brains, especially in the entertainment industry, is there was such a huge lack of curiosity or empathy when it came to socio-political issues. But the exciting thing about it, I mean, like I said before, once I discovered the work of someone like a Thomas Sowell, or, you know, even, I mean, I know he's a very divisive figure, but someone like Jordan Peterson, I'm an atheist, and you know, but I find his views on Christianity to be really interesting, and it makes me want to explore more deeply why stories like this, you know, have endured over time. What is the power of story to move an audience, and why do some stories endure and others don't? You know, the topic of economics. I mean, basically, it's sort of an intellectual awakening. And, you know, I'm reading old novels. I'm studying Greek plays right now and reading Aristotle. And it's like, wow, all this stuff that I really should have been reading, that should have been a part of my education, or maybe more a classically liberal education, that have been deprived me. It's a very, very exciting time. And you just see things in a new way, maybe perhaps a broader way. You have access to a more nuanced perspective. But what that does is that it begins to alienate you from from a lot of your colleagues. Yeah. And I began to notice over time, I said, God, the level of discourse is so poor. I mean, we're seeing it now with the reaction to the election results in Virginia, where people they can only think on one track, and it's all about race and white supremacy. And I'm thinking to myself, it's such a boring, limiting, self-limiting way to view the world. And it just doesn't take into account the idea that there are lots and lots of people from many, many walks of life that that just don't see things the way that you do, and for completely valid reasons. Sort of a digression, but one of the things that I found really exciting about the last few years and the development of technology and social media is that now, for the first time, the idea of fame or a star system is sort of becoming obsolete, because now I'm seeing that just normal people sitting in front of a webcam and giving their opinions tend to be far more interesting than all of these glamorous and glamorized celebrities that really aren't that smart or that interesting. So it's been, in terms of rabbit holes, it's been great to go down these paths and say, wait a minute, the ordinary person, when they are engaged in something that that they are really passionate about, is extraordinarily compelling and just fun to watch. You can learn from them. In terms of bad rabbit holes, it's difficult because, you know, I've had this sort of conversation with friends. It's like, am I becoming one of those crazy sort of anti-vax people? Because right now it looks like Alex Jones is having a better track record than many of our trusted news sources. And I don't want to be that person who was like, you know, they're turning the frogs gay. But at the same time, where do you go for information? I mean, you have to take that stuff with a huge grain of salt, obviously, because, and I think part of the issue that people like us are having right now is that it doesn't matter how sensible you are, you're still going to be lumped in with people who think that there is no virus, people who are talking about, 5G towers and small organisms that are inside these vaccines, you know what I mean? Like flat earthers, that kind of a thing, because that's the only place that these people can have, or one of the only places that we can have a broader conversation about this topic. But in general, I guess the short answer after my long-winded response is that, I've just become more curious. And, I think life is even more fascinating. People are even more fascinating. But at the same time, you become more aware of, I'm doing what I guess some refer to it as syntopical reading, just about the rise of authoritarian societies or totalitarian regimes. And when you are reading, Solzhenitsyn and all these other works around these periods, I mean, I'm less interested in like specific dates and when things happened. I'm more interested, and maybe this is the actor in me, in the psychology and the emotion underneath all of these things. And once you become more sensitive to that sort of stuff, then I joke with my friends, I'm becoming one of those people who was like, yeah, it's these damn commies everywhere who are just ruining everything. And that's the cost of it, I guess, as well, is that you become more burdened with seeing things in society a certain way, and it becomes even more disturbing. But I guess the flip side is that you become more motivated to speak out and act and to push out against it.
Well, the last thing I want to ask has to do with your tagline on Twitter. The Jordan Peterson of actors. I want you to explain to me what that means.
It's a joke, really. There was somebody, I started a podcast recently. It's called the Clifton Duncan Podcast. And I upload the episodes to YouTube. And somebody in the comments, I don't know if they were being tongue-in-cheek or not. I mean, I hope they are. People who know me know that I've been a class clown my whole life. I don't take myself that seriously. And someone wrote that Clifton Duncan is the Jordan Peterson of actors, which You know, I just thought it was funny, so I put it. I put it in my handle. I certainly hope that. And someone asked me yesterday, you know, do you think Jordan Peterson refers to himself as the Clifton Duncan of like sociopolitical? I
was like, should
I? Well, I know. Well, I certainly. I hope he doesn't. I certainly hope not, because that would be probably bad for the both of us. But so it's really more of a tongue-in-cheek kind of a joke, and I take amusement out of it.
Yeah, I love when somebody has a funny line like that. You think that is too good not for me to poach and go do something with. I feel like I'm sorry to be dwelling on this so much and such a fanboy, but there was one of the times I saw a play that goes wrong off Broadway. Some of the actors were, because I think they were doing that Equity Fights AIDS thing, so they were holding the bucket for people who give donations. So all the actors were out in the hall so I could meet them. And I got talking to the guy who played Inspector Carter. And I just said, you know, I just can't thank you enough for all the energy you bring to this and how much joy it brings me. And I said, I would be embarrassed to tell you how many times I've been here. And he says, well, if you've been here a lot of times, you'll know two things actually legitimately went wrong today. Do you know what they were? And I said, oh, sure. The match didn't actually light the fire today. And the second level didn't collapse right away. It collapsed later on in the show. Hmm. And he said, yeah, that's exactly what went wrong. He said, but we actually rehearse alternative ways of for the play going in case some of these things don't happen. And I said, oh, that's funny. I just thought you were ad-libbing. So I just love the intricacy of this crazy play.
Well, it's, you know, it's funny because the guy who plays the inspector off Broadway is a guy named Matt Harrington, who I was in, we were in the same class at grad school. So it's funny that we both ended up on this journey.
Oh, but yeah.
That play, it's so, obviously, I'm biased, but I sort of took offense when people would say, oh, it's just low comedy.
No.
There is such a, first of all, just the idea of I, Clifton Duncan, am playing a character named Robert Grove, who himself is playing a character named Thomas Collymore. So you have to, and what they do at the beginning of the rehearsal process, that they handed us the play that goes right. And it's so ridiculous. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like a 30-page script. There's nothing in it without any of the jokes and gags. And it doesn't make any sense. But you have to understand how the play is supposed to go in order to be able to say, okay, so you're working on multiple levels as an actor. It's like, okay, on one level, it's how, you know, if there is a problem that arises, how would Robert Grove handle this, knowing who he is?
Yeah.
But also, how would Robert Grove handle this through his interpretation of Thomas Collymore?
Thomas Collymore, yeah.
Right. So it's just, it was a very interesting challenge. And you know, there are a lot of sort of contingency plans and things that sort of go wrong. But I think if people knew the kind of technical specificity and, I mean, we call comedy tragedy plus timing anyway. I mean, there is just so much that goes into putting on this show. I mean, and the set itself, I mean, the set won a Tony Award.
I remember that. I love that the set, it was like I had one of my books won an award for the cover. It had a beautiful cover. And I always felt like, isn't that funny? The one part of the book I had nothing to do with, that wins the award. And then I remember when I heard that the set had won an award, they made some kind of short video about this. Like, yeah, now you can't, it's so full of itself now, you can't even talk to the set because it had won the award.
Yeah, no, the Mischief crew, I mean, they really made something very special. And, you know, one of the things about it that was so great is that the show itself is completely apolitical.
Yes.
So at a time where things were so divisive and, you know, there's so much going on, here's a little show you can go see that just has no politics involved whatsoever. As soon as you hit the door, you get comfortable in your seat, they're already working on you. And it was just great to be a part of something that brought so much joy to so many people. And it was a good time. I wish, and sort of goes back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, I mean, where people are trying to tell me, you know, just get the jab or whatever, or, you know, stop crying on the internet, you made your choice. And it's like, well, you know, I herniated my L5 and I have a wrist now that is an unstable joint because, I mean, I literally gave my body to this profession only to be locked out of it now. And there are, unfortunately, a lot of performers who, I mean, Konstantin Stanislavski, who's the great Russian director and writer who sort of is most well known for bringing what's now called the method style of acting to the United States. But he once said, love the art in yourself, not yourself in the arts. A lot of people love themselves more than the art, but there are a lot of us as well who say, you know what? I love my job. I just want to work and keep my head down. I don't need any special accolades. I don't need to be famous. I do want money, but yeah. I just need, this is just what I do for whatever reason. And when that is stripped from people, you know, part of the, I was talking to a mentor about this. Part of the downside of my moderate success as an actor is that, I mean, I haven't needed a job, a survival job in years, but on top of that, I mean, I haven't really worked on any other skills. I mean, I improved my singing and improved my on-camera technique because they were serving me. So now I'm in a position where I'm starting from zero in a lot of ways. And, you know, I don't know what the future is supposed to be for me now, because it certainly was not waiting tables in Atlanta, Georgia. That was not in the plan. And by the way, it's funny because the restaurant that I work at, there's a lot of shows that shoot and film in Atlanta. So I'm treated every day to all these people who come in fresh off of the set, you know, these nice toned, clear-skinned actors, writers, directors, producers, talking about all the things they're working on, what their friends are working on, what they're shooting next. And it's very humbling, shall we say, to experience that. And my thought is that, you know what, man, I mean, I've done nothing wrong. I've literally done nothing wrong. I minded my own business. I went and got a new job. I didn't complain. I just said, I'll just wait till this blows over. But now I am seen as a scourge and a horrible, evil person, doesn't care about other people. And it does a number on you psychologically and emotionally. And hopefully it's always darkest before the dawn. Maybe the dawn is around the corner. I'm not sure what that is, but right now, I'm not sure what else to do. So, I mean, I'm happy that people like you have reached out and allowed me to at least tell my side of the story. And again, I want to thank you for being one of the few people speaking out about the loss and the destruction of the arts when the art makers themselves have not done so.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, of course, I'm doing it because I think it's important for, you know, for the spiritual side of mankind, as well as because I personally happen to take great enjoyment in it. And there are just these little kind of irreplaceable memories that I have. And by coincidence, one of them involves the play that goes wrong. The very first time we saw it, I was not by myself or with a, I would proselytize for this thing. If I was out of town or in from out of town, I would say to one of my friends, hey, come with me and see this play. But the first time we saw it, I had three of our five daughters. They're the only three we thought were old enough to be able to enjoy it. And just to look over at them during the performance and see them in absolute, we were in the very front row, absolute hysterics is to this day one of my happiest memories with them. And then the original guy who played Chris Bean, who's Henry something or other, mm-hmm. There is this part of the show where he so-called breaks the fourth wall and addresses the audience.
Yes, yes.
And one of my daughters was laughing so hysterically that he singled her out and shouted at her to shut up. And then it so happened that her parents, we were sitting way on the end of the row and she was the farthest daughter away. And so he said, look, your own parents don't even want to sit next to you. You're such an embarrassment. This to her was like the greatest achievement of her life, was to get the attention of that actor on that stage, you know? So just something silly. And then we came back the next night. During the intermission, I said, okay, we have to bring Elizabeth, one of our other daughters. I know she'll enjoy this. We're going to come again the next night. So we got tickets that very moment sitting there. And so the next night we came, and Chris Bean, you know, being the director of the Cornley Society, you know, Drama Society, yeah. He's going up and down the aisles in his tuxedo, and he spots my daughter, remembers her from the previous night, and just glares at her and keeps going. It was so great, you know? So I can't believe that this is the way it ends. There's just a part of me that just refuses to live in a world in which this is how it ultimately ends. So, you know, we're in the middle of a story, we're in the middle of history, and who knows how it turns out. But I'll say this, I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/2001, both to the Clifton Duncan podcast, which you could also get to by just typing it in, but easier might be tomwoods.com/2001. We'll have the link to your podcast. And then people need to be following you on Twitter at Clifton A. Duncan. They have to be following you. I'm glad to see you have 51,500 followers. You should have more. But that's pretty darn good. It's probably better than most of the Broadway actors who are just repeating the same old thing over and over again about wearing masks or whatever. So that's something. But I've really enjoyed talking to you, and doggone it, I just hope someday we wake up and we're in a different world.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I do think it's funny that I've attained more relevance now than as a what I call a mediocre Twitter personality than I ever did as a performer. So maybe that's the silver lining. I mean, I've had a lot of great responses from people who are outside the sort of New York progressive bubble, who say, you know, I mean, my YouTube channel is mainly Shakespeare videos and my podcast, and people are really responding positively to that. So what I've learned is that there's definitely a lot of people out there who want more of what we're talking about, that spiritual nourishment, which has become a theme of a lot of my conversations about the arts. So maybe perhaps the middle of this story is that more and more people will begin to understand me. One of my pet peeves is that we talk about the culture war this and the culture war that, and we do talk about important topics like economics and policy. But if we continue to ignore the arts and artists, I think that's also a dangerous path to go on. So hopefully people like you and I can sound the clarion call and help people understand, like, look, you know, we're out here too. And, you know, we have a voice, and it's not the same sort of leftist orthodoxy that you're used to. And we need support as well. So hopefully the following will continue to grow, and I can continue to apply my skills and bring joy to all kinds of different people from all over the world.
All right. Well, that is the spirit. So I'll link to both of those things again, tomwoods.com/2001. Thank you, Clifton. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, remember, tomwoods.com/2000 is where to go. Watch that 2000th episode. And of course, before the actual event, I had two different receptions with people who support the show, people who belong to the Supporting Listeners program. That's yet another unannounced bonus of being part of that program. So I'm constantly doing things like that. I've opened up my own house, my own home to people for events that I've had. Again, not just to get us through the craziness of 2020, but just as a genuine thank you to people who support me. So I would love to have you part of that group, because not only do you get these unannounced bonuses, but look at all the regular bonuses you get. It's ridiculous. I don't know of anybody who gives this many bonuses to people who support him, but I really appreciate the support. So, of course, you know one of the benefits is membership inside the Tom Woods Show Elite, which, you know, that little voice in your head is correct on this, at least on this issue. You belong in that group. So check out the details, how to support the show, supportinglisteners.com. You get lots of value in return for your support. So check that out, supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.